This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to another exciting edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. This is episode 13. I'm your host, as always, Elwood Jones from the Deputy TV Hell. And joining me, of course, is my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer of Eastern Kicks and Guila Ramblings.
Hello there.
On tonight's show, we are going to be looking at the 1966 Shaw Brothers classic, Come Drink With Me. As well as that, we are also going to be looking into basically how this film revolutionized the martial arts cinema and a lot of many of the things that it brought to the forefront, much like Five Fingers of Death. But before we obviously get into the meat and potatoes of tonight's chosen film, what has obviously been holding your interest since the last episode, Stephen? I mean, what's really been on your sort of watch bar, if anything?
Well, non-Asian terms, I finally saw The Last Jedi and came down on the there's some great set pieces, but I don't care about any of these new characters, so I guess that dates me. And I saw Black Panther, where I thought there's lots of wonderful things about it, but I wasn't really grabbed by it, and I did a bit wonder, is it Emperor's New Clothes time about that? Let's try again. And in Asian film terms, turned out I owned House of the Flying Daggers in four different formats, well, three different formats, and I'd still never watched it. So I finally saw that. So I owned it on Hong Kong DVD, a UK DVD, a UK Blu-ray, and a PlayStation Portable UMD version. I had never got around to watching it in, I don't know, 10 years, 13 years. And I was blown away by its beauty.
Yeah.
But again, I've had a bit of a month where I've been a bit disappointed by everything, really. And that just topped it off. So I own it four times and I've only mildly enjoyed it.
Yeah, I don't know how to really talk about House of Flying Daggers. Yes, it's very pretty in places, and it goes through all the seasons, which is great, after we went through all the colours of Hero. And it's the trilogy that I sort of come back to the least. And it's a shame, really, because everyone talks about Hero, and they talk about House of Flying Daggers. But they never talk about Curse of the Golden Flower, which for myself is probably one of the most superior entries of the trilogy, and perhaps the most straightforward as well. I don't know, I think it's sort of put an end to a while for that sort of art house action film. I mean, we had all the excitement of Crash and Tag Hidden Dragon, and then Hero sort of followed on afterwards, and a lot of people saw it as like a continuation. But by the time we had House of the Flying Daggers, I think the interest kind of died for sort of mainstream moviegoers, and we've never really had anything to sort of follow it up, really.
Yeah, I mean, it gets criticized, so sort of Zhang Yimou gets criticized a bit because he's clearly making movies for the Western audience. Because I think sort of Chinese viewers had seen all this before, maybe not in the wonderful color-coded, season-coded stuff that you talk about, but there's nothing there that's new. I mean, it's got Takeshi Kaneshiro in, who always makes anything better that he's in.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's got Zhang Ziyi, who I just cannot connect with at all. Obviously, clearly a great actress, very beautiful, but I've never been able to get an emotional connection with her of any of the characters she plays. And the whole film just is a nonsense. It's got these fantastic sets of pieces, but none of it needed to happen. I don't want to give away, in case other people like me haven't seen it yet, but so all the reveal upon reveal upon reveal at the end, you think, what was the whole point of the previous 90 minutes?
Yeah.
it's like, huh? And I just sort of came out of it It was like a very sweet boiled sweet that was probably too much sugar in it and actually didn't really fill me up at all.
Okay. I mean, I can't say that I've been watching anything more, any more high class, really. I mean, I've watched, since last recording, I actually checked out both the first two films in the My Wife's a Gangster trilogy. The first one is absolutely fantastic, and the second one, not so fantastic, despite a lot of people telling me it was actually better than the first. If you're obviously not familiar with the trilogy, it follows a female gangster known as Mantis in the first film, and then bizarrely she's renamed Silverfish by the second film with no apparent reason, and she reconnects with her long lost sister, and who wants her to see her get married and have children, despite the fact, not knowing the fact that her sister is actually this stone cold like triad boss. So her and her underlings are basically trying to organize this funny wedding. They managed to find this salary man to actually marry her, and he seemingly is the most unwitting person ever, as she constantly rejects his advances and basically codes all hell, beating him up regularly, and he seemingly is quite happy to stick around for this, despite the fact she's absolutely horrible to him. And the first one's really got this wonderful blend of like comedy and some fantastic action sequences, and the second one is a little more awkward because she basically loses her memory and ends up working at some sort of local noodle bar as a delivery driver and trying to remember who she is. So it kind of veers off into the same sort of territory as The Long Kiss Goodnight, but it became really heavy on sort of like these sort of perverted groping jokes, and I just couldn't get on with it. But Zhang Zi does also show up as a cameo in the end, despite the fact that she's heavily sort of listed in the credits there. You think she would have more than a cameo role, but sadly doesn't. I mean, have you seen either of the My Wife's a Gangster movies?
I can do better than that. I've seen all three.
Have you? I know the third one's on Netflix randomly over here, so.
The third one replaces Shin Eun Kyung, who's the lead Korean actress, with Shu Kui, interestingly enough, as a Chinese gangster. But we'll forget about that. I actually really, really like the first film. Like you say, it's an interesting blend of sort of crime drama and comedy. The only thing I will say is something really dark happens. Shall I spoil it?
I think you warned me about it before, but you can remember which film it was in.
It's in the first one. So it's a 2001 film. I think we're out. I think spoilers can go out of the window. But the lead character, she gets pregnant, and she gets kicked in the stomach and has a miscarriage, and it's quite, I don't know, it just feels at odds with the I know the general subject matter isn't necessarily comedic, but I was quite disturbed by that, and I think that sort of took it down from a, wow, this is a fantastic film, to a, yeah, this is a pretty good film, but, ooh, I didn't like that bit.
Yeah. It's, I mean, the first one, so, it's got such a great blend of, like, action and comedy. It was a shame that we didn't get more of the same when it came to the second film. I mean, this is a film where your lead sort of heroine of sorts, yeah, your anti-hero, her weapon of choice is a pair of scissors. When we say scissors, they're more kind of like shears that can be like separate off into two blades. There's an absolutely fantastic scene where she's taking on a rival gangster in a field. They're having this knife fight to the death, and it's shot very much like a Shambara sort of fight scene. It's all very over dramatic, and it's the first one film I would say is definitely worth checking out. I've yet to see the third one, so I can't comment on that. But the second one is more sort of hit and miss. More surprisingly, though, was the film adaptations of Attack on Titan. I mean, Simon, I know you're not an anime fan, but if you sort of bought into Attack on Titan, or
no, I haven't. I'm aware of the was it a single film or was it one of those double ones that they're?
It was a double one. It was so. It basically covers the first season of the anime. this being, I mean, that if you like Game of Thrones, then I think you'd like Attack on Titan, because they both basically work on the same premise. You've got complex storylines with numerous twists and turns. You've got mythical creatures, and you've got your favorite characters randomly being killed off at any given moment. The film version differs slightly from the actual anime in the fact that it all takes place in the city, so you lose all the stuff outside the actual cityscape. And I feel that it actually worked. The changes that they made for the film version obviously worked, mainly because you have to sort of scale it down, because in an anime you can do basically anything you want, but a film version you've obviously a little more restricted. But it's inspired my recent revival of interest, so to speak, in anime. I actually finished off season 2. I got the last 6 episodes of season 2 scratched off, and I don't know why I suddenly took a break from watching it, because it is a great little anime, and it's also pretty accessible, especially if you're not like a sort of traditional anime sort of fan. There's enough action in there to keep it interesting. If you don't want to read subtitles, you can always watch the pretty decent dub that's on Netflix. They're still actually waiting for season 2 on there, but you know, you can always watch it with the subtitles on Crunchyroll and watch it that way. But yeah, I mean, I'm eagerly awaiting season 3, and at the moment is now sort of biding the time watching Bungo Stray Dogs, which is also really good, but I'm only a couple of episodes into that. So I will probably have a bit more to say on that by the time we record the next episode. But, I mean, can you be tempted to watch Attack on Titan, or yeah, is it just the anime that aspect that...
No, it's... I didn't hear very good things about it, actually. I'm not against watching... So these live... There's quite a lot of... we could probably do a whole episode on live-action remakes of anime and manga properties. But this thing... Japanese cinema did get a bit into this two-film thing of adaptations in the last sort of 3 or 4 or 5 years, Attack on Titan being one of them, but also things like Assassination Classroom, Library Wars, although that's a sort of a novel adaptation. And there's also the Takashi Miike one where he'll never make the second version. I can't remember the second film, but it's it seems to be a thing. I guess we kind of explored it a little, didn't we, when we looked at Death Note?
Yes.
Which, again, sort of killed itself dead by saying, and by the way, there's another film coming, and think, oh, really? And I find that a bit of a struggle myself to, you know, I don't mind a sequel, but I don't like it when it's planned. I didn't like it when Harry Potter did it. You know, it just feels like if you can't do it in a couple of hours, you ain't going to be doing it in 4.
I just started thinking, you expect him to cram 5 books into 1 movie then, but I realise you're talking about Deathly Hallows now, aren't you? So
yeah, indeed. So you know, I do. Yeah, a film series is okay, but turning a film, splitting a film in half, I find a struggle. But you never know. You said Game of Thrones. You know, I like that. I like a bit of a politicking going on with my head cleaving. So let's see.
And that's it. I mean, it works being split into 2 films. I think it has a decent, like with Kill Bill, it has a great endpoint, and it gives you a bit of breathing room when it goes into the second part, because it's. But yeah, I liked what they've done with it. They seem to be going on their own unique track, especially compared to the anime. So even if you've seen the anime, while certain scenes and characters will seem familiar, there is obviously these elements that have been added to the film version, and I think both properties stand on their own merits. I thought the film version is some great action scenes there. The Titans, it's an interesting effect that they've done them with, but the Titans always looked awkward in the anime and the manga to begin with, so I think that's not so much an issue there. But yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. I think it's worth checking out if you're a fan, or if you you can just watch this even as someone who's never seen the anime or read the manga and and still get something out of it. I thought it was a really enjoyable watch. So,
so you would say the move from anime to live action in this case worked better than the move from live action to anime in Godzilla that we talked about last time.
Yeah,
this way worked better.
I think the recent Godzilla, I think I've been kinder than a lot of people. I was listening to the Blade Licking Thieves and their review of it, and apparently they colorfully described it as passing a kidney stone as being more enjoyable than watching it. So but certainly, also on the podcast run, though, I mean, Blade Looking Thieves is a show that we recently discovered as part of our review roundup that we've been doing for films now on here. So if you have got any reviews or podcasts about Come Drink With Me, please do send us the links and we will post them as part of our review roundup. And it's all part of building the community of Asian cinema fans and lovers, and just, you know, bringing everyone together, because it's nice to know who else is out there and share opinions on these things, because even though it may feel like a more sort of open and well-supplied community now, at times it does feel that, you know, there's a lack of people to actually discuss these films with. So it's great to obviously stumble across their podcast. Much like ourselves, each episode of their podcast, they look at a different film or an anime series, and they discuss, and they also talk about other aspects of Asian cinema, and it's a really interesting podcast, and one definitely worth checking out. They've got a good banter there as well, so yeah, if you're looking for some accompanying podcasts to go with this show, then Blade Looking Thieves is definitely one worth checking out.
But don't forget to come back here.
Yes, listen to us first, and then if you've still got time, listen to them. Yeah, obviously, I mean, just obviously, while we're on the subject of anime live-action adaptations, I mean, Netflix have recently put up their live-action version of Fullmetal Alchemist, which I've yet to watch. I mean, I've still yet to watch the live-action version of Death Note, but after everyone bashed it, it's kind of been a little lower on the watch list than it perhaps was when they first announced it. So,
yeah, and you don't need to bother asking me. I haven't seen it.
You've not seen it. That's fine.
Even though I was given Netflix a big up on all this stuff, I haven't. So it's hard enough. They Jessica Jones came out the other day, and I'm struggling through that. That's 13 hours of my life. It's finding time to invest in new stuff on Netflix is really hard, because there's just so much content out there.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're best off, well, obviously on the subject, though, of Come Drink With Me, I think we're best off obviously going into our feature pick tonight, which is obviously the Shaw Brothers film Come Drink With Me. This film was released in 1966 and is seen by many people as providing the blueprint for many Watson movies for the things that it did first, much like the likes of Five Things of Death, also known as King Boxer, which gave us things such as like Miller's Earth. This was the Shaw Brothers once again really bringing some unique ideas to the screen, and a lot of things that we now consider to be standard sort of action and wuxia sort of traits, they really sort of did first here. But, I mean, Stephen, this was obviously your pick. I mean, what really appealed to you about Come Drink With Me that you wanted to obviously cover in this episode?
Well, for me, my background, I think we've talked about before, I came to Asian cinema through horror, through cult and indie films, and I actually had avoided wuxia cinema completely because I found it quite intimidating. There were these sort of famous names, and you needed to know about fighting styles, and or at least I thought you did. And I found, well, so someone told me to watch this. So basically, this is a case of me remembering my first time. And, you know, what a great film to be to be introduced into a whole sort of subgenre. So you're quite right. it's an exceptional example that did set a lot of the standards and the tropes, and you can draw a line, for example, from Come Drink With Me all the way through to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Yeah, that's not just with the our act, this film being in both, but in some of the things like the double-decker in scene and things like that. So I think I chose it because it was my first, but also because, as you sort of rightly said, it set a whole bunch of tropes and standards in cinematic terms in for Wuxia film that carried on after this.
Yeah, I mean, the film itself is directed by King Hu, who did a number of important sort of martial arts films. I mean, after Come Drink With Me, he also did Dragon's Gate in A Touch of Zen. He also did The Swordsman and Painted Skin, which sort of rounded out his career in 93. Now, he originally came to Hong Kong, and he worked, didn't obviously come straight in as a director. I mean, he was an advertising consultant, he was an artistic designer and producer for various sort of like media companies, as well as an English tutor. And then in 1958, he joins the Shaw Brothers Studio, originally as a set director, actor, scriptwriter, and assistant director. And he was working under the Taiwanese director, Lee Han Hsiang. And he basically, through him, he was sort of set on the path. I mean, with Come Drink With Me, it's actually his first film. And here we also see the debut of Chang Pei-Pei, who really only started studying martial arts when she signed up for the film. Before that, she was actually a ballet dancer by trade. And I think when you certainly look at the film, you can see, certainly with her movements, that where her dancing training is really coming into effect. And she follows a trend. There's other, obviously, dancers who have gone into martial arts, such as Zhang Zi, as we mentioned before. Michelle Yeoh, as well, was also from a dancing background. So it's quite common that you would have people from that sort of background that obviously transition into martial arts. And it works well because they obviously have that, you know, that training for body control. I mean, what did you obviously make of Chang Pei-Pei as obviously our heroine of this film, God and Swallow?
Well, I mean, she's remarkable, I think. And I think the whole thing, you know, she's this tiny little creature, fairly unemotional in it, but says a lot with her eyes. I think, yeah, I say that a lot. But the film is designed, she was specifically chosen because she was a ballet dancer. So like what I said earlier about, you know, sometimes I can find the whole fighting thing a little bit off-putting because I don't understand it enough. I don't have the knowledge to understand it. This is a much more stylized approach. It's not, you're not going to see amazing, this isn't a Jackie Chan for one. This also a this isn't like a lot of the Shaw Brothers output of a similar time, which is about the athleticism of it all. This is stylized, this is almost dance like, but not in a sort of a posy indie way. I'm just thinking of some of her action scenes. It's not all about sharp edits and things like that. It's kind of flows, doesn't it? And she's this tiny little petite little thing, but when you just know she's carrying herself in such a way, you know, like when she's in the inn and everyone's sort of turning on her, and interestingly, she always gets called by a male pronoun, doesn't she?
Yes, I mean,
so it's kind of it's playing on this opera, Chinese opera thing where quite often, in Peking opera, normally men play women, but in some of the other styles, things like Dream of the Red Chamber, the Bridget Lin film, Lin obviously made a career of this as women playing men, and so that's an operatic tradition out in a different form, in the Yellow Plum opera style. So they call her that, but then she just takes them on, and it doesn't feel wrong. It doesn't feel ridiculous. It just feels right.
I don't know how you would describe her character. I mean, she's obviously the Guns one. She's the been sent in by the local general to rescue his son, who's also her brother, and has been captured by this group of bandits who want to basically exchange him for their leader. So she's been sent in to see if they can sort of like, if she can get him back without it turning into like major sort of bloodshed. And when she's obviously introduced, I mean, as you said, she's always, they always use like the he pronoun. And while she's obviously in the local inn, which should be noted as well, it's also a double story inn. That's a first for the genre. And it's, as I said, it's now, if you look at the films which follow, they were always like the two-level inn. And certainly when we look at like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, we've got the inn fighting where she essentially spins up to the top floor. We don't have anything that sort of fantastical in this one. Although Chang Pei would obviously go on to appear in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon as Jade Fox. And, I mean, she's actually still working now, which is the amazing thing of about Chang Pei. Because I thought she was pretty much retired, but apparently she has been working quite regularly since this film. Which really sort of like served to announce her before that. She was sort of like playing bit roles in the couple of films that she did before it, but this really sort of announced her as a talent to watch. Sadly, the films later in her career haven't been as perhaps as memorable when she's doing things such as like Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li. But certainly the early films, she is, as you said, she's got such a presence. When we look at her when she, during that opening scene when she's into like the inn, and you've got this sense of foreboding sort of doom. I mean, you've got bandits like are all hiding in amongst the customers there, and you can tell that something's going to go down. And the fact that she's just there like cool as a cucumber and doesn't react to it at all, and she's doing fancy dart tricks with the coins, I thought was just pretty cool. And she has a really cool look as well with that awesome hat.
She does. It is awesome. And also later on has a really cool hair as well. So, I mean, she's just, you can see why at some point He Who Must Not Be Named was going to get Quentin Tarantino to make it, remake it. It never happened, thank God, because I wouldn't want it to be spoiled. But, can you just see Uma Thurman in that role as well, or something like that?
Well, I mean, do we think if Tarantino remade it? Because I know obviously the Weinsteins did buy the property, as you mentioned, and it was still one of those properties they bought the rights to, but they never did anything with it. And I know that they probably bought it for Tarantino because obviously him being the golden boy of the studio, they basically want to give him the sort of projects he wants to work on. And I know that he's obviously said on multiple occasions what a fan of this film he is. But I mean, it's a difficult film to watch normally, because I mean, while it's very highly regarded, it's sort of struggles in places. And I mean, this is probably my third time watching it, and while there's obviously these many good moments, you also have some perhaps not so great moments, such as when we look at the character of Fan De Pei, also known as Drunken Cat, who is basically, he's introduced as like the village drunk. And he's here played by Yun Ha. And he's there when he's got his group of annoying kids that he wanders around with, like a Kung Fu Piper. And it turns out, of course, in true sort of martial arts Kung Fu cinema sense, that he's, of course, a secret Kung Fu master as well. We also have in here, we have the very theatrical Smiling Tiger, played by Lee Wan Chung, who, much like you were saying about that whole Peking opera sort of sensibility, he's got the white pancake makeup and he's a very theatrical villain. Even if he isn't obviously the main villain of the piece, he's got that very theatrical element there to him. But I mean, how did you obviously find the character Drunken Cat? Did he annoy you as much as he annoys me?
No, because I'll tell you why. It's because this was my introduction to some other key elements of Wuxia films.
Okay.
So we have the honourable hero, yeah. Who's Cheng Pei-Pei, the Golden Swallow. You know, she's very set in her goals. Even though they add an element of family to it, it's her brother she's trying to save, and she's trying to do the right thing. The Drunken Cat character, of course, is probably modelled on the Beggar So character from sort of Chinese legend stroke history. And also, it's like it's the forefather of sort of like that Drunken Master character that obviously Jackie Chan would later popularise. But it's a quite a strong trope. Is trope the right word? Archetype character. We get introduced to, in my copy it was called the Jade Faced Tiger, but the pale pantomime Peking opera looking thing, to my mind, he's your classic eunuch. They don't actually say it in this, but you know, and that's another staple of later Wuxia cinema. There's the fantastic costuming and set design, of course, and of course, as you mentioned, the sort of the fight in the dual layered inn. So to me, the Drunken Cat character is just one of those standards that you will see in other films. I know a lot of people think he's actually the weakest part, but I found him quite enjoyable. I'm not convinced by some of the sudden burst into song they do. There's a little musical number in the middle of about a third of the way into the film, which then does lead into something where he gives her a clue in his second song. But the first song's just like, what? But that, again, kind of introduced me to some of the madness that can happen in a Hong Kong film, even though I have to say sort of King Hu's films are not normally renowned for things being made up on the fly, like a lot of Hong Kong cinema.
Yeah, I mean,
this is a well thought through film, apart from the end. But we might talk about that in a minute.
Ah, it's just like when he was going into that musical moment. I mean, this is worse still because this most recent viewing I watched through Amazon Prime. Now, Amazon Prime only had the dub version, and I'm not sure who dubbed Drunken Cat, but he's probably the worst actor that they could have got in. He's like, you made an annoying character somehow more annoying, which is always an achievement.
I think it works better with subtitles, and but it is, you know, it's a common criticism of the film that they don't think he's strong enough, and of course he doesn't feel strong enough against this amazing presence of Cheng Pei-Pei next to him. But something must have worked, because he had a heck of a career afterwards as well. So maybe it's just us, you know. It's the light that Cheng Pei-Pei is shining on across the whole film is maybe making us a little critical of him.
It's, I mean, he's when he's just basically dicking around during his like initial introduction, and when he's doing those annoying songs. He's so, he does nothing for me. But obviously once he reveals himself as the martial arts master, and which bizarrely means he's Golden Swallow then being pushed to the background, which kind of, you spend all this time like building her up as this invincible heroine who's going to kick all these asses, and she basically goes to the temple and manages to get her ass handed to her, and we think, oh, that's fine, that's part of the hero's journey. You don't win the first time. You get your ass handed to you, and then you come back, and you hand your opponent's asses to them instead. But instead, he's obviously revealed as the martial arts master when he saves her, and then it basically becomes his story. Until sort of right at the end, when Golden Swallow turns up with her own sort of army of female warriors. It's sort of like the opening of Wonder Woman suddenly that this film turns into, where we've got all these amazing female swordswomen?
Swordspersons.
suddenly turn up and you think, well, where the hell were they then? Earlier in this
year. Where have they been all along? So it's interesting you say that, actually, because this is a Wuxia film, And normally they have sort of rules around them. So almost every other Wuxia film will start, as you rightfully described, they'll be at somebody and they'll go on a journey and they'll be relatively unskilled or they'll be a horrible person or something like that. And that, you know, that they'll battle the bad guys and fail, but that will put them on the path to being a better person and learning the martial arts skill. In this one, actually, Golden Swallow herself is fairly fairly well skilled up at the beginning of the film, and she gets hurt, but she doesn't really learn from it. And our other character, the drunken cat chap, is already a kung fu master. We hear about his journey through exposition, but we don't learn anything. So basically, our two lead characters already fully skilled up. It's just about events taking on that sort of take over the narrative and force them into certain places. So it's actually a very un-Wuxia-like Wuxia film. Now, interestingly, Run Run Shaw, of one of the Shaw brothers who produced this, hated it. Absolutely hated it in rushes. This wasn't what the sort of films that they'd been making up to now, and that's why the focus suddenly changes in the final act, and it goes from being Cheng Pei Pei's movie to the other guy's movie, and suddenly people are shooting air jets out of their hands, and the his brother appears, vaguely hinted about. Is he the abbot guy? I can't remember.
Yeah, so basically
the whole story just suddenly changes, and it becomes a very different film. It's very well done, but it feels almost like the last third of the film is a different film altogether. And that was basically so King Hu could get the film finished and made and put onto screens.
Yeah, he's it's the abbot. The abbot's obviously the drunken cat's brother, who apparently has this. He apparently killed the mentor and stole this all powerful weapon. And as I said, it just felt like a different film. And I mean, we've obviously seen this hero's journey in numerous other times, but we've also seen it done better. When we look at things such as, you know, like King Boxer or 36 Chambers Shaolin, there's just better examples of this.
I haven't seen ever done by exposition before. You know, there's no flashback.
No.
There's no. They just talk about it, and in a quiet moment. And it wasn't until I watched it this time that it became clear to me. So, wow, it really is. It's not following the rules. So even though it's my first one, I've watched an incredibly atypical film for of the type.
The plotting issues aside, there is some really nice martial arts work here, especially some great swords play. The issue comes to the fact Chang Pei Pei is not a martial artist, so it does. You can obviously see it in some of the movements. It's more sort of like dancing at times than actual sword play. Certainly, some of the extras she's obviously going up against don't particularly sell hits as well. So there's a lot of her waving her swords in the air and people like flying backwards and that sort of thing. But it looks nice on the screen. A lot of these fight scenes look absolutely fantastic, such as like the battle at the monastery. Certainly the opening and closing fight scenes look great as well. And it's surprisingly bloody as well, especially for a film of this period. You normally expect to sort of like the later Shaw Brothers movies, but certainly we get limbs hacked off, we get blood spurts, and it took me a little bit by surprise just how violent this one opens as.
And there's some pretty dark stuff in there. The little boy monk that gets killed. I mean, that's like, whoa, where did this come from? It doesn't pull its punches. And of course, again, being my first time, this was my first exposure to that wonderful red blood that a Shaw Brothers film can be full of at times that looks utterly unrealistic, but at the same time, you know exactly what's going on.
Yeah, I know what you You see, I tend to associate that sort of thick red blood paint with more the Baby Kind Power series, and I think it's mainly because they were more liberal with the Crimson in their films than this film, that it kind of stood out as much as it does. So.
And of course, we also got we also get sort of a so the other thing about Wuxia films, actually, I mean, one of the things about being a martial artist is that you can bend the laws of nature a bit. And we do get a little bit of tiptoeing over the roof, don't we, as well? So again, this is very much the mold that Crouching Tiger will later take. You can see huge elements of it in Ang Lee's later version, which is probably why I didn't like Crouching Tiger very much, because we'd seen it before.
Yeah, I mean, it's while this film can obviously be cited as having all this influence on the genre films, it's I just don't get why so many people refer to it as like this greatest martial arts movie of all time. I mean, yes, Chan Pepe is really good in it, and she's got very good visual sort of appearance and style in the film and presence, certainly. But I just think if I'm when I think of like my favorite martial arts films, this doesn't, I wouldn't say is up there. I mean, this is after the third time I've watched it, and there's just so many elements, especially in the middle parts, and certainly when I'm having Drunken Cat going for his musical moments, that just provide more frustration than enjoyment from this film. Even though I can obviously see how influential it's obviously been to the films that followed. Certainly when you look at, and it's the same as when you look at like King Boxer, and the fact they're using the Miller's Earth, so that white talc sort of burst that you get when people are hitting each other or landing on the ground, so that little puff of talc that comes up, that Miller's Earth, that was obviously originated there. And you can certainly see where elements have been originated here and when they're doing first. And I'm sure that when this film was first originated, probably really may have had like such a much more of an effect on the sort of audience viewing it for the first time.
Well, you're absolutely right. So I've got the Dragon Dynasty DVD. That's how I watched it.
Yeah.
And there's an interview with Choi Hark, who later worked with King Hu in his final couple of films. And in fact, we'll talk about that more when we get to recommendations, I think. But And he said he went to see it as a young man, and it was completely different to the films that they had been seeing up to now in terms of its cinematic nature, in terms of the costuming, the set design, Cheng Pei-Pei herself, the things that they were doing. It was far more cinematic than the films that had been up to then. And I do wonder, is this a film that has... A bit like they talk about the Velvet Underground's first album, yeah? Not many people bought it, but everyone that did started a band. Is this the film that maybe it isn't the be all and end all, but everyone who's seen it was inspired to take bits from it, and therefore it seeded a wider genre? I don't know.
Possibly. I think it's one of those, it probably is in one of those films it can be seen as. And certainly when there's numerous people obviously citing it as this influential film. For myself, I mean, though, I would say it still remains problematic. I mean, it's certainly enjoyable, and it certainly doesn't run on too long. Definitely get a hold of the subtitle version if you can. Do not watch the dub version, as it is pretty... It's pretty horrible.
I have to warn you, though, even the Dragon's Dynasty DVD hasn't got fabulous subtitles. I think there are better around.
I'm not sure, because I'm the same as yourself. I got the Dragon Dynasty one as well. I mean, this is, again, why you buy a multi-region player, so you can actually get hold of these. Yeah. Because I don't know what it was with Dragon Dynasty. We had Basic Chambers of Shaolin. We had King Boxer come over here, and then they stopped it. They never really did anything else here in the UK, but they had quite a decent selection of Shaw Brothers titles released stateside. Amazon at the moment have an absolutely astounding selection of Shaw Brothers titles. Obviously mixed in there, and I don't know what it is with Amazon. They seem to just be adding anything that they can at the moment, especially sort of genre cinema. And it's great the fact that you can now watch so many of the Shaw Brothers movies through them if you've obviously got a Prime subscription. So seeing how very few are actually here available to us folks in the UK, much like the Godzilla movies, it's probably best that you take advantage of these films while you can, because you don't know how else you're really going to watch them so legally over here. So,
indeed, and I think iTunes has a few as well. I think I certainly had to review a bunch for Eastern Kicks, and they were all through iTunes. So streaming does seem to be the way to go.
I mean, that obviously brings us to the end of our obviously discussion about Conjuring with me. I mean, further watching, I mean, where do you want to go next if you obviously enjoy this one?
Well, I'm going to pick four films. One, and hopefully I don't cross over with you. So actually, there's a sequel a year or two later called Golden Swallow.
Yep.
Cheng Pei-Pei, same character. It's a bit different and it's maybe a bit more traditional, but I think it's actually really entertaining. You know, it's not up to this level, but it's a pretty good, you know, as these things go, it's a pretty good one. However, where I'm going to go is King Hu's next film was Dragon Inn, which is really good. But that inspired a whole bunch of other things as well, including a fantastic 1992 remake, New Dragon Gate Inn, by Raymond Lee, produced by Choi Hark, starring Theron in the year. And then I would go for The Flying Swords of Dragon's Gate, which is a reimagining of it by Choi Hark, starring fabulous people like Jet Li, Zhu Zhan, and Gwen Lun Mei, a Louis fan, Mavis fan, loads of people are in it. The first 3D Wuxia, which I was lucky enough to actually see in 3D. I'm not usually a fan of 3D films, but it really works. So basically, there's a Dragon's Gate trilogy made by three generations of filmmakers in three different styles, which are all really good.
Yeah. And you managed to go with exactly the film I was going to pick for this next. For watching there. So, I totally agree with you. I was also going to choose New Dragon Gate Inn, especially because it features Bridget Lin, who you recently did a piece on for Eastern Kicks. So,
I did indeed, yes. So I've got Eastern Kicks because it's Bridget Lin sort of being honoured by the Hong Kong International Film Festival. I did a little bio of her. It's a bit more than that's on the Wikipedia, and sort of I was just trying to show that she was a partly inspired by one of the talks we had about great women of Asian cinema, about the fact that she was an icon of Taiwanese cinema before she was an icon of Hong Kong cinema. So please go and check it out over at Eastern Kicks.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, with New Dragon Gate, and it also features Bridget Lin, much been in it, she's playing a woman passing off as a man, which she obviously did in like, so Peking Opera Blues, Saw Ottoman 2, and it's it ties in very nicely with that sort of with our own heroine Cheng Pei-Pei, obviously being mistaken for being a man at the start of obviously this film as well. So, but no, I mean, either if you're going to watch Dragon Gate Inn or New Dragon Gate Inn, they're both really great. Some especially with New Dragon Gate Inn, I think that was like along with Jet Li's Hitman, it was sort of like one of my entry titles into sort of martial arts cinema when I started picking up like the Hong Kong Legends tapes.
For sure. I mean, it's a film for stargazing. So, you know, you get to see Bridget Lin, Tony Leung Ka-fei, Donnie Yen. You get to see a different Maggie Cheung than you'll see these days. Yeah. You know, which, you know, before she became a sort of the indie darling. You know, this is a very different sort of bouncy around character, which is a lot of her early work is like that, and it's just it's just you know, it's got a brilliant plot, it's got twists, it's got a bit of black comedy in there, it's great martial arts, and it's another, I would say, sort of one of those tentpole films that of the wuxia genre.
Cool. Right. Well, I mean, obviously, this brings us to the end of another edition of the Hong Kong... Brings us to the end of another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. Obviously, our next episode, it's now my turn to pick, and the film I've chosen to go with is... We're gonna mix things up slightly. We're gonna go for a drama, and because we've been covering sort of very, traditional sort of films. So we're gonna go for something a little more obscure. So we're going to go with the film Turtles Are Surprisingly Fast Swimmers, which is it's a 2005 feature film from the Japanese writer director Satoshi Miike. And which it sees a jury funeral playing a housewife whose spouse is overseas in business, and she basically finds herself discovering a tiny flyer advertising for Spies Wanted. This is certainly a unique film, and I'm looking forward to obviously discussing it. I know this is one that you're a fan of, Stephen, so...
Juri Ueno is my number one Japanese actress. She's brilliant, and I'll be talking lots about her, I am sure, during next episode.
So we're gonna talk about Tales of Spicy and Fast Women's on our next episode. But in the meantime, if you do want to follow us, you can follow us either on iTunes. We're on Podomatic. We are also on thatmomentin.com, where we are part of the podcast network. So definitely check us out there as well. You can obviously follow us as well. We are on both Facebook and Twitter, as well as you can also check out our homepage as well, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com. Stephen, obviously if people want to come and follow you and read your stuff, where's the best place always to find you?
Well, you can find me at my own blog, although I have to admit I'm not doing a lot of writing on there at the moment, but that's guelorambling.wordpress.com, but there are about 400 reviews on there for you to go through, so I think I have been busy in the past. There'll be some current stuff up on easternkicks.com, so you kindly sort of mentioned my Bridget Lin article. There's a review coming up soon, if you're into Bridget Lin, of Dream of the Red Chamber. It's just to show that I can do Yellow Plum musicals as well as wuxia films, and you can get me on Twitter at lpvo.
As for myself, I'm on Twitter, which is at @Elwood_Jones. I've also got, you can check out my blog, which is fromthedepthsofhell.blogspot.co.uk. Please do let us know what you think of the show. Let us know your thoughts on Come Drink With Me, either on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from yourself. And if you're on iTunes or Podomatic, please do leave us a rating and hit that subscribe button. And maybe let us know, leave us a little review on there as well, because it all helps the show, raise the show's profile as well. But obviously, this brings us to the end of another episode. Thank you, as always, Stephen, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
And we will be back next time with Turtles Are Surprisingly Fast Swimmers. Good night. Hey! 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 昨日の恋は忘れて 昨日のあの子は忘れて 踊り続けていたい 夜なのさ月が砕け散っても星が燃えて落ちても踊り続けていたい夜なのさ胸に刺さった恋の刃が燃える思いを狂わす No, 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 no,
昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。